The question was about the long-awaited fifth and final volume of the English translation of the Philokalia. I know something about this because a few years ago, Metropolitan Kallistos invited me to help him bring the volume to completion. And I began to do a lot of work on that, and I don't know what happened afterwards, but somehow he never followed through, and I don't know what his plans are about that. The good news, though, is that a lot of the, Father, where are you? So I can maybe some. Oh, there you are. The good news, though, is that a few of the works from the fifth volume were already translated in the fourth volume. So there's only about 150 or so pages of Greek text that needs to be translated, and of those 150 pages. A good percentage is taken up by a lengthy work by Saints Kallistos and Ignatius, the Xanthopuli. It's translated. I mean, the title goes under different names in English, but it's Methodos ke Kanon. So it's sort of a method and a canon or a rule for those seeking to live a hesychastic life. Now, there's an English translation of that work in, I think, the 1951 or 52, whatever it was. Volume by G.E.H. Palmer and Karlubavsky. But that translation was based on the Slavonic, or I'm sorry, Russian, because the Greek, the Philokalia was published in Greek in the late 18th century, and 11 years later, the first Slavonic translation appeared, and then a second edition of the Slavonic Philokalia was published. And then there were multiple Russian translations after that, including one, I think, by Theophon the Recluse. So the translation of the work by Kallistos and Ignatius that's in the Palmer volume is based on the Russian translation. And it's a bit of a paraphrase, but it's better than nothing. So the good news is that there are some works that are not yet available from that fifth volume, but not too many. It's not as if there are great secrets or surprises, and we have the bulk of the Philokalia. The other thing, this is kind of funny actually, that a couple of years ago when I was teaching a course on the Philokalia at the seminary, I got a letter from a colleague on the Holy Mountain who said, oh, I know you're teaching this course. You should know that the entire Philokalia, including the fifth volume, has now been translated into English by a group in India. Right? And it's a facing page, I'll probably say this wrong, but maybe I won't. It's a facing page Malayalam text with an English translation. Right? And I think they've reprinted the four volumes that are available in English already, the ones that we've had. But the fifth volume, they say that they thank Kallistos Ware for his draft translation of the fifth volume that they took and apparently polished up and have published. Now, it seems odd to me that Bishop Kallistos would give them the draft and not give it to Faber and Faber or make it available to all us. So I don't know what happened there or how they obtained it. So the fifth volume is available in an English translation. It's a little hard to get, because it's not available on Amazon or anything like that, and because the Indian organization that published the fifth volume, I'm sorry, this might be a little bit too technical or boring, or it's sort of Philokalia sort of gossip or something, or what's behind the scenes sort of, you know, the foundation that I suppose supported the translation and published it is a non-profit organization, so they can't even sell these things. You've got to get their telephone number, which somehow I found, I don't remember. I think I had a research assistant, I made him, you know, do a lot of Googling and found it. You have to call them and argue with the Indian guy that answers the phone and persuade him to send you a big box with these huge volumes and comes packed with like shredded up Indian newspapers from Calcutta. It's quite a, you know, so, and he'll try to talk you out of it. He's like, oh no, you don't, he goes, you couldn't possibly be interested in these. I said, no, I really am. He goes, well, you can't read the, I said, I want the English translation. He goes, but what for? You know, so, and I explained and he said, oh, well, I guess, okay. He goes, you know, the books are big and the postage will cost a lot. I said, well, I'm more than happy to pay for the postage. He goes, oh, no, we can't take money. It's a nonprofit. And, you know, so we went back and forth like that. But they eventually came, and you know, I should try to actually scan them, and so we can just make them available to people, though. But so that's the, I think this might be unkind, but it could also be very true. I think that that actually the main translator was Philip Sherard, that G.E.H. Palmer probably provided a lot of the money because he was from a wealthy family, and I think Sherard was the main translator, and Bishop Kallistos was sort of the theological advisor. But I don't think that Metropolitan Kallistos is the kind of man to sit at a desk for long hours and undertake the painstaking labor of translation. It's just not who he is. I think Philip Sherard was the one who did all that work, which is why we haven't seen anything since the day Philip Sherard died.
You know, Father, I was surprised last year, this month, I interviewed Metropolitan Kallistos on the subject of the Philip Sherard.
Oh. So excuse me, so now you show your cards, right? So
certainly not, Father, certainly not. I was asking because he surprised me. I expected exactly what you just said, that basically we were never going to get the fifth volume. But he said in the interview that, in fact, he was thoroughly engaged presently in the fifth volume. And that's why I was asking you, because I was just now listening to you, assuming perhaps you were engaged with him in getting it done.
Well, I was, but somehow he changed his mind, and maybe he's engaged to somebody else right now, so I don't know. Forgive me.
Father Max Norris, did you know Elder Emilio Norris? And could you tell us a little bit about his spiritual stature? Or could you tell us something about him?
I had the great blessing to meet Elder Emilianos, for those of you who don't know, is the former abbot of Simonopetra, my monastery, who many years ago began to show signs of something like a degenerative brain disease. It's sort of, I guess it's like Alzheimer's, but it's not exactly Alzheimer's, and it began to affect his centers of speech and communication, and then things deteriorated after that. And he's still alive. Convalescing, we have a very large convent in Chalkidiki, or Milia, some of you may know it. And he's been there for many years, basically in a kind of comatose state. I mean, he looks good, he's not on machines or anything like that, but he's just not able to communicate. But before that happened, where are you, Father? I'd like to be, oh, there you are.
Father Michael.
They all go to the back for some reason after the question. I was as a college student. I would travel to Greece whenever I could, and to the Holy Mountain. And I was there in the 1980s at some point, and just by chance, it happened to be the vigil of Saint Mary Magdalene. And then Bishop Silas, the Greek Bishop of New Jersey, now of blessed memory, happened to be there. He was invited because at the Athenite monasteries. And other monasteries, they invite a bishop to preside over the vigil service. And he was the presiding hierarch for the vigil. And because he knew me and I knew him, I somehow was sort of, you know, there's a Greek expression, next to the basil plant, the pot gets water too. So I was the pot that was getting the water from the basil plant. And I had an opportunity to spend time with the elder. And I, even though I didn't know who he was, because I didn't know who this man was as in terms of his what you described as his spiritual stature. But it was obvious that he just had tremendous energy, and he was just a very unique kind of a person. We had the vigil, and the next day in the refectory, the bishop spoke, but the abbot spoke as well. And I had never heard a sermon, a talk, you know, sort of like this in my whole life. And that was quite extraordinary. But when I went to the monastery to become a monk, he had already taken ill, and he was already at the convent, convalescing. The current abbot is, his name is Eliseos, which is the Greek way of saying Elisha, the disciple of Elijah. And in monastic culture, people who get the name of Elisha are usually somehow tagged as the successor of the abbot, right? Because the Elijah to Elisha, and the sort of urban legend in the monastery, if you will, is that from when Elder Emilianos first saw Elder Eliseos as a 16-year-old kid, he said, this man will succeed me as the abbot. And that's exactly what happened. There's a book called The Way of the Spirit, which is a collection of talks by Elder Emilianos, and it has a lengthy introduction in there that that sort of answers your question. So if you can get a copy of that, I mean, I think that would be good to read. I have a PDF file of it, a scan that I could send to you, because the book I think is out of print. But without going into a long story here, I mean, he was born to refugees from Asia Minor who fled Asia Minor in the 20s. He was born in Piraeus and went to the University of Athens with the idea of becoming a lawyer. He was originally enrolled in the law school, I think for a year or two. Then he decided that his family, they were very pious people, decided law school wasn't for him, then entered the theological school. And then when he graduated with a degree in divinity, he wanted to be a missionary. This is in the late 50s, early 1960s. This was at a time when missionary work was unheard of in Greece. Nobody was doing anything like that, except one person who is now the Archbishop of Albania. At the time, he was a layman involved in the Greek, I don't know what they call them in English, the brotherhoods, the lay brotherhoods. Anastasios Yanoulatos, he was just a layman, and he was the pioneer of missionary work in Greece. And, well, not, I mean, from Greece, I mean, the missionary work was to Africa and other places. And Elder Emilianos, who at the time was just a theology school graduate, Alexandros Vafidis was his name, heard about Yanoulatos and went to him and said, I want to join you on your forthcoming missionary trip to Africa. And the Metropolitan said, he goes, you can't come with me. He's like, he was taken aback. He says, you think you can just take your degree from a theological school and then be a missionary? He goes, you're not ready for this kind of work. He says, you wouldn't be able to handle it. You don't know what you're asking for. The elder's desire to do this was so strong. He said, well, what do I need to do? He says, you have to go and spend time in a monastery first, whether it's 1 month or 3 months or 6 months. You have to fast, you have to pray, you have to prepare yourself for this tremendous spiritual work. He goes, what do you have to offer people right now? I mean, facts, right? Data, information that you've gotten from books, right? That will never be enough to sustain you in the work that you have to do. And at the time, Metropolitan Dionysios of Trikis, they say Trikala, another very interesting person who harbored British paratroopers during the Second World War and was arrested by the Germans and sent to Dachau and survived the camps and was brought back to Greece later on, became the Metropolitan of Trikala. Trikala is the diocese in Greece that has the monasteries of Meteora in it. And Trikis, Dionysios, being the bishop there now, made it his top priority to revive monastic life in Trikala, which was, I mean, at a low point in its history. So Yanoulatos knew Dionysius very well. He says, go to Trikala, go to Dionysius, and he's working with these monasteries down there, and just go there, and we'll talk at some later point. So he went. I mean, it's to the elder's credit that he took the advice of Yanoulatos, and he went, and the elder has many stories about his time in the monastery. Initially, he hated it. He hated it. He was an Athenian. He had a theological degree. He had studied law, and he was living now with these Greek hillbillies, basically, in this right run-down, decrepit, sort of ramshackle monastery in the middle of nowhere, basically. And just the monastic life at that point was at an all-time low. One of the monks had been in jail for trying to sell manuscripts from the monastery, and the services were at a very mediocre level and all this kind of thing. He talks about it in a lot of the talks he gave at the monastery. But it was while he was there, he underwent this, I mean, there's really no way to describe it. I mean, a kind of life-transforming experience. And he talks about it actually in, this is actually available in English. It's a talk called The Prayer of the Holy Mountain. And like St. Paul, he tells a story about a monk that he once knew, right? But it's actually him. I mean, all the insiders of the monastery will tell you that. This is actually his own story. And while he was in the midst of a profound spiritual crisis, while he was in the midst of just really spiritual agony and torment, he was really didn't like the monastery, felt like he was in prison, wanted to go and study in Germany or Switzerland, and was fighting with it. Everything was just, right, it couldn't be worse. It was in the middle, he felt like he was being suffocated. Right? And it was in the middle of that horrible sort of moment that he had an experience of the uncreated light, which initially filled the cell. And then he looked out the window, he didn't know where the light was coming from, and he saw that the courtyard of the monastery and everything was illumined. And he went outside. I mean, it's a long story, and I'm not prepared to tell it in all its detail, but again, to tie it in with what we're gonna be talking about, he says that he felt that all of creation was saying the Jesus prayer. Right? And that the prayer at that moment entered into him, and it's probably safe to say that it never left him after that. And his whole life changed at that moment, had no interest in going to Africa, had no interest in ever leaving the monastery. Right? He had discovered himself in the context of the monastery, and he set his vocation after that became that of a monastic leader. And very quickly, he attracted all the young men and the women of the surrounding villages began to flock to him, and pretty soon he had a monastery and a convent, and the older members of the Brotherhood of Simonopetra and Ormelia, those are those 15, 16, 17-year-old kids who were attracted to him at that point and who never left him and who are still there. I'll tell you one story. This is one story about them. This is Father Gregory. Father Gregory is the music teacher at Simonopetra. We like to tease him because he has a platinum CD. He's the author of Agni Parthene, right? Agni Parthene Despina Grande Theotoke. That has a history too, by the way. Someone has traced it back to a Middle English Christmas carol, but that's a whole other story. So I received a blessing from the abbot at one point to produce a biography of the elder. And I got permission from the abbot to interview all of the old monks who knew the elder. And I heard a lot of great stories, but the one from Father Gregory is a good one. Father Gregory was maybe 16 or 17 years old at the time. And he was living in a kind of a dormitory that the church in Trikala had for, you know, kids who weren't from wealthy families. And one day the teacher came into the classroom, and he said, well, he goes, tomorrow the abbot from Meteora, this is Elder Milianos, who was very young at the time, the abbot is going to be coming to our school to hear your confessions. Now, it's not mandatory, but everybody has to go, right? Father Gregory said, I had never been to confession before, and I certainly had no interest in the church, not to any deep degree. I wanted to be a teacher, and I didn't know what to do. So one of my friends had a piece of paper. He said, here's a list of sins, he said. You take this in when you go in to see the abbot and just read them and everything will be fine. So he goes, I had the piece of paper, and it was his turn, and he went in. Now, you have to be with Father Gregory when he's telling the story, because it's like he's in that moment. And he opens the door, and he walks in, and the next thing he saw, the elder had very large eyes. He saw the elder, and Father Gregory remembers every detail, what the color of the carpet, what the elder looked like. I mean, it's right? It's like he can just walk into that moment. I mean, the degree of detail that he recalled. And he says, the first thing that I saw were the elder's eyes, and it was like he was looking right inside of me. I had the feeling that I was just a book that had been opened and he could read everything inside me. And the paper fell on the floor, and because I don't, you know, we talked about other things. And he goes, and at the end of that conversation, 16 years old, I knew that I was going to be a monk. And of course, Father Gregory's been a monk his whole life. And he goes, and never, I have never, not even once, ever, certainly never regretted that decision and never thought twice about it. So the, I mean, I just want another quick story to give you an idea of what kind of a man he was. Another older monk in the monastery, his story was that he had gone to the monastery as a visitor. He was a younger man from Veria. And there was a church service, I don't know if it was a vigil or a great vespers or something, and he didn't know who anybody was. He was standing in the church, and at one point a monk walks by him, and just as he passes him, he sort of touches him on the shoulder. And the moment that contact was made, he said, I felt myself just go empty. I said, well, what do you mean exactly? That every thought that I had, every idea, all the activity of my mind just somehow ceased. And it was an emptiness that wasn't a void, of course, right? It was a void. It was an emptiness that was an openness to God. And he felt the presence of God, because it was as if, like against St. Paul, as if scales had fallen away. And he turns and he goes, who was that? Who was that? Oh, that's the abbot. And he made the decision to, I think he stayed there after that. And so what can we say? There are times in the history of the church where people like this appear because they're needed for obvious reasons. And then, you know, then there are long dry periods that follow. But I mean, how can you explain my explanation is that the saints are people who never say no to God, that God reveals himself to them, they have an encounter with God, and that's it. All of us have had experiences of God's grace, but an hour later, a day later, we make commitments, we make promises, and right, it passes. We go back to our old habits, and like, hey, what exactly happened to me the other week? Remember that? We don't even remember it. We remember something happened, but we don't remember what it was. But I think the saints are people who, when they have that experience, they never leave it. They never leave that moment or that space, or they never say no to God. So I don't know how else to make sense of it. So it's a different kind of a thing. Sorry for the very long answer, but
the question required.
Father Maximus?
Yes.
Forgive me if this question seems a little personal. It's sort of a follow-up question in a weird way, but having one foot in the halls of Harvard and Yale and the other foot at Sinopata seems to me to be a very wide span indeed. So if you would tell us a little bit about the balance of keeping one foot in one world, and if it's too personal, tell us about a monk that you once knew.
I wouldn't agree to the idea that I've ever had one foot in Harvard and one foot in Simonopetra. I mean, if you know anything about monks, you know they're all or nothing kinds of guys, right? So when I was at Harvard, I was at Harvard. There were 2 feet there. And when I left Harvard to go to the monastery, that's where the 2 feet went. So, I mean, that I was trained as a scholar and that was something that stayed with me, well, that's unsurprising, right? But in terms of my identity, and in terms of my sort of existential location and commitment, I mean, when I was at Harvard, I was at Harvard. And when I went to Simonopetra, I went to Simonopetra. And I mean, when I was, I think, 17 years old, I mean, that's when I received my monastic calling. And I tried many times after the age of 17 to jumpstart that, as it were. And every time it failed until the right time came. And I realized later on, again, from something the elder used to say, that, you know, God often gives you the idea to do something, like to become a priest or to become a monk or to get married or whatever it is. God often gives you the idea, but he doesn't always give you the nerve to act on the idea with the idea, right? So I think it was important that the idea be given to me, because if I didn't have that idea, well, then my life would have moved in very different kinds of directions, right? But the nerve to actually act on it, that, for reasons that are unknown to me, that had to await a later time in my life. So it did occur later, but it wasn't anything new for me. It was something that had been there, not just as an idea. I mean, it was a calling, but tomorrow, I think, or the day after, we'll talk about the difference between a seed being planted and then the cultivation of the seed. So the seed was put there, the idea was put there, but the moment of its flowering, I suppose, had to wait till later. So, you know, I don't experience a tension between what I used to do and who I was and what I am now, you know. So that might be a little disappointing, but you're stroking your chin as if you're a little skeptical.
Very refreshing.
Okay. So, and, you know, we have a tradition of learned, you know, monks in our church too, right? Monasteries are very learned places. Even if you don't ever go to the library, just by going to the services in the refectory, over time you will acquire, a rich, and by the interaction with the other fathers and so forth, you will acquire, a profound education, right? So,
Deacon, off.